Hey there, Brandon Harvey here. Before we get started, I have some really exciting news from the Good 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 team. We have officially started shipping out issue 5 of the Good Newspaper, our print newspaper filled with good news. This means that if you're a subscriber, this issue should be arriving really soon. If you haven't already ordered issue 5 yet, you're not going to want to miss out. Inside issue 5, we include stories of journalists working to save democracy in unique ways, Mormons showing up to support LGBTQ youth, Nigerian heroes, inclusion in the intimate apparel sector, and the global eradication of polio. Uniquely, this issue also includes a good news story on how to plan a wedding that's ethical, environmentally friendly, and gives back. This issue has all of that and more, and you're really not going to want to miss out on all of the real messy hope inside. It is also just so beautiful. I can't wait for you to see our centerfold poster and, oh my gosh, so much more. I can't keep talking about this. Visit our shop at goodnewspaper.co to order this issue or subscribe for the entire year. You can also click the link in our show notes. All right, now here's the show. No matter who you are, whether you're the CEO of a Fortune 100 company or in the third grade, you have weirdness inside of you. Just think about it. Before we figured out that it wasn't okay to stand out and do crazy things for fear of rejection, we had a period of our lives where we weren't afraid to do stuff. We had outrageous ideas and probably said some things to our parents, classmates, and neighbors that would freak our adult selves out today. What if we started fearlessly rediscovering the person who we were before the world told us not to? That's what CJ Cassiata is passionate about, getting weird again. And I'm thrilled he's my guest on the podcast today. CJ is an author, speaker, and media producer who has helped some of the world's biggest brands, including Lululemon, the United Nations, MGM Studios, and Whole Foods, discover their unique identity and share it creatively. He also spends time speaking around the country at places like TEDx, Story Conference, and Charity Water. And if that's not enough, he's now the author of his newly released book, Get Weird: Discovering the Surprising Secret to Making a Difference. We'll be talking about that today, including how weirdness just might be the key to changing everything. It's going to be so much fun. I'm Brandon Harvey, and this is Sounds Good. This is the weekly podcast where we have conversations with inspiring people who are rejecting cynicism and using their lives to make an impact. Sounds Good is not your typical 3 Steps to Success podcast. We don't host this podcast for the sake of leaving you with bullet points on self-improvement. We deeply believe that our lives are more complex than that. So we show up here on Sounds Good to ask big questions, dive into nuance, and learn from each other's stories. I'm so excited for you to learn from CJ today. So here is our conversation. I was thinking, knowing that you were coming over, when did you move to Nashville? Did we move around the same time?
It's going to be 4 years in October.
Okay. So for me, it would have been 3 years in a little bit before October.
Yeah. I think I remember hearing whispers of you, the Brandon Harvey, the Seattle guy. It was Jetson's best friend. So, I mean, he was, my friend's moving here. And so, yeah, I think we were here for a couple of months.
Great. Well, and I was visiting Nashville before that because I was dating Sammy. So we may have even met in real life before that.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Where were you at before Nashville again?
We were in Southern California. So we kind of were in Orange County and then hung out in San Diego for a little bit. But we were Southern California people.
Man, what brought you? Because you weren't from Southern California.
No, I'm from Long Island, New York.
And those are opposites. How did you do that?
And now I just kind of am right in the middle. Smack dab, you're like a third coast.
Averaging it out.
I wanted to study media and filmmaking and music and production. And so now I look back and I go, gosh, New York City is actually a pretty good place for that. But for some reason, I just wanted to get out of the small little town that we were in outside of New York City and go to the West Coast. And so I went to California and then I spent about 11 years there.
When you grow up in Long Island, do you spend much time in Manhattan or do you just kind of not need to?
Now it's like, I talk to 16, 17 year old CJ in my head and go, what were you thinking? Like, this is New York City. Like, that's how come you didn't stay here? But I wouldn't have met my wife if I didn't, you know, go to California and all of these other cool things. But, you know, it's, I feel like life's kind of like a choose your own adventure book, you know?
Totally. Well, and I mean, the media world really is in Hollywood. There's a lot of it in New York. But if you're like, oh, I want to get into story, you know, New York is still largely business focused.
Sure.
With a little bit of the extension of, you know, some media stuff. And then LA, California feels very much storytelling media.
Yeah. And it's funny, like when I was in California, I felt like I kind of had to hide my New Yorkness a little bit because, you know, I would say there's when I was in college, me and my roommates were trying to move around our furniture. And I kept on saying, hey, so what are we going to do with the AMWA? And nobody said anything for about like 5 minutes. And I said, hey guys, what are we going to do with the AMWA? And they're like, what the heck are you talking about, CJ? I'm like, the AMWA, like, the armoire, the closet.
That's
and I'm
funny.
Like, yeah, the AMWA. And so that they don't let that down. I'm still friends with those guys today and they don't let me forget that. But now that I'm in Nashville, I kind of like, I don't know. I have like a better ownership of my New Yorkness again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like, yeah, I'm actually from New York. So, and I think I just, New York City is just so, it's not getting any less cool, you know.
No.
It's the epicenter of culture, and
yeah,
I'd love to hang out there for an extended period of time, maybe for a summer or for a fall.
Yeah.
in a little bit. That'd be really fun.
Growing up, did you know, was your game plan the whole time like, I want to get into media game storytelling game?
Yeah, definitely. My heroes growing up were three guys. It was Jim Henson, Mr. Rogers, and Walt Disney.
Mm.
And I just knew that I wanted to do something in that vein where I was creating content for, we call it content now. Nobody would have said, you know, 7 year old CJ, yeah, I want to create content, branded content and content that's like, you know, social and snackable. No, but I wanted to make stuff that grown-ups and kids could watch together and both get something out of.
Mm.
I would say a close fourth was George Lucas. You know, I remember seeing Star Wars for the first time.
Totally.
Going, like, this is amazing. And why isn't there a whole lot of stuff out there today, you know, that does that? So
yeah,
that's been the dream.
In your new book, you talked about this idea that most of us get the weird kicked out of us before we have the chance to cultivate it for good. Was that something that happened to you as a kid? Because, I mean, because it sounds like you maintained that vision, you know, throughout growing up.
Yeah, and that's actually directly related, I think, to that vision of wanting to create that kind of stuff and live that kind of life. I don't think I have maintained it very well at all. I think maybe on the outside it might seem that way, but you know, every day is sort of a choice and a challenge to go, how am I going to live today? Am I going to live out of that 7-year-old version of myself?
Yeah.
Or am I going to live out of fear of not kind of coloring outside the lines? And that's just an everyday choice I think we make, just in the same way it's a choice to, okay, am I going to actually be a good husband, a good dad, a good friend, a good son today? One of the choices I got to, you know, sort of intentionally make is like, what am I going to live out of today? Am I going to live out of my inner kid or my scared, afraid grown up?
Yeah, I mean, I think about that all the time because the world I work in, half of what I do is straight up business. It's looking at spreadsheets. It's communicating. It's Slack and, you know, all these things. And then the other half is straight up creating things that have never been created before and trying new things and feeling like I'm innovating and working together. I never feel like someone's pulling at me to do the creative stuff. Nobody's ever pulling at me like saying like, hey, you've got to make this thing happen in the world. But people are always pulling at me to do the businessy boring stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it doesn't come naturally at all for me to lean into the stuff that feels like it's coming out of my heart. But I don't know. Like, I'm just grateful I get the opportunity to do that. But it's a choice every single day. It's really, really hard. And most days I probably don't succeed at that. Most days I do kind of fail into, okay, let me feel like overwhelmed and stressed by these grown-up things I have to do.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a binary, you know, boring business stuff versus creative stuff. I think it's a posture of going, where can I find childlike in a sense today. Where can I operate out of a childlike place where the things that I think cripple us as grown-ups, the fear and the worry about the unknown, and the priorities that sort of grip us don't grip us anymore.
Yeah.
And you know, you can look at a spreadsheet, you can do something quote unquote business-ish through the lens and through the eyes of childlike wonder. I really do believe that. But I think it takes just a certain amount of reflection and intentionality.
Yeah. No, that makes sense to me. Maybe we should back up for a second and talk about, because we're like getting deep into it, but you know, you wrote this book, Get Weird, about this idea of weirdness. Where did that idea come from? Why weirdness?
Yeah, you know, I was kind of trying to figure out, I talk about this in the introduction of the book, I was sitting alone in a pub in New York City because, you know, I was trying to pitch something that wasn't really working out, and I was honestly feeling a little down about myself and where I was headed or where I wasn't headed. And I was like, gosh, what do I do? I was helping companies, you know, with their messaging and branding and communications and creative strategy and all that stuff. And I really liked this whole idea of, you know, some of my passion projects were really more about helping people kind of figure out what their unique identity is. And so I just was like writing down in my journal, and I wrote this word weird down, and I went, oh my gosh, that's a one syllable version of really what I'm doing. I help people and companies and leaders figure out what makes them unique in a sea of similar thinking, in a sea of same. And I kind of like the word, but am also still scared of it. I remember being scared of it in that moment when I wrote it down, going, wait a minute, weird. Nobody likes to be weird. That's actually a pretty heavy word. Like, I don't feel like I'm weird. I'm on my own lawn. I tell dad jokes. I when I'm shopping for clothes, I'm literally like shopping with the intention of fitting in and just not standing out. But I think on the back end of writing this book and speaking about it and consulting about it, I think it's kind of a beautiful sort of juxtaposition where, yeah, I'm this normal dad guy, dad bod dude who is embodying this message and this identity of weird, because what I've found and what I deeply believe in writing the book is that we're all weird. We can't escape it. We're all created with this unique combination of matter and spirit that nobody in human history has been able to duplicate. And so if that's true, what do we do with that?
And I love this idea that what we're doing is we're trying to find what makes us weird rather than trying to create weird. You know, it's an uncovering, not a creation. Because if you try to create weird, then it's probably BS to some degree.
Yeah, the book is actually falsely titled. It really is. I mean, it's not, you can't get weird. You are weird.
Mm.
And so how do you live that way?
That's funny. That's really interesting. It's I'm a huge fan of the bait and switch when it's used for good.
Yeah.
And so people are like, oh, cool, I'll get weird. You know, because sometimes it's hard to look inward and realize, oh, I am weird, or there's a weird that I buried and I've been missing out all these years.
Yeah.
And so it's probably comforting for people to pick up the book and go, oh, okay, cool. Like, this will teach me how to get weird. And then once they've already purchased it, they're already invested, they're like, oh, dang, I got to do some work on this. I got to make this happen.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay, so how do we do this then? So if we're all born with weird, and maybe break down a little bit more what that means first. Like, so what's this innate weirdness that we're born with?
So it's you know, no pun intended, it's really weird. I ended up looking up that word in the dictionary and really doing that late in the game. Like, somebody had told me, well, have you ever looked it up? And I'm like, actually, no, I haven't. And I was really surprised at what I found. It weird is... there's a definition, it's pretty early on, it's like number one or two, but it says suggesting the supernatural.
Hmm.
So weird isn't just this word that we throw at people. I mean, we do, but it's not appropriate just to go, oh, that's weird, or, you know, I don't understand that person or that thing or whatever, and it's weird. Weird has this sacredness to it, you know, this weight to it where it suggests the supernatural. And so regardless of what we believe about the universe and why we're here, you know, there's something different about us as human beings that we can all sort of point to and go, okay, there's something deeper going on here. Like, otherwise, why be empathetic toward each other? Why practice kindness? Why innovate new solutions? We're weird, and that's a really good thing. And so how do we excavate that?
And so how do we excavate that?
Yeah, well, again, you kind of already alluded to it, but at some point, the weird gets kicked out of us, right? It could be a bully, it could be a coach, it could be a parent. You know, we're all born with this innate imagination. When you were a kid, nobody needed to teach you to imagine monsters, you know, or come up with crazy fantasies or draw different, you know, I used to draw cars that turn into planes, that turn into submarines. Like, nobody gave me a guidebook and said, this is what you should do. We, our natural predisposition as children is to operate out of our weird imaginations. But that gets kicked out of us over time. We start conforming to patterns. And again, it could be a lot of different reasons. But by the time, you know, Mark Twain has a great quote. He says, you know, we bury men at 72, but really they die at 27. And so usually by the time you're 27, you know, that weirdness gets kicked out of you. So excavating that is really about tapping into that 7-year-old version of yourself, that 8-year-old version of yourself. Elie Wiesel, who won the Nobel Prize, you know, years ago, but he obviously was found himself in a concentration camp when he was a kid. And in that speech that he makes, he goes, I turn to the boy now who's in that camp. I turn to the boy version of myself. And he's asking me a question. He goes, what have you done with our life? And so a really good practice would be just to kind of reflect and go, you know, if I'm looking at my 7, 8-year-old, 9-year-old self right now, I want to imagine him or her asking me the question, going, hey, what have you done with our lives?
Yeah. So when your inner 7 or 8-year-old asks you that as a grown adult man, how do you respond?
Yeah, it's funny. Somebody asked me that question a while ago and posed that question, and I would respond, you know, we're doing what we said, we're doing what we talked about. So chill out for a minute, okay? Get a little defensive, but it's a lot harder than I think we thought. So I did a big pitch to a Hollywood executive a couple of months ago and was really nervous the whole time about it. And the one thing that kept me sane and kept me from like running out the door was, you know, 10-year-old CJ thought this would have happened by now. And 10-year-old CJ would have been like, of course we're pitching to this person. This is what we do. This is what Jim Henson has done, and this is what Walt Disney did. And so, like, what's the matter with you? Why are you so nervous? This is the thing that we do. And that's literally, and that's actually funny. That was before my friend Ian told me about the Elie Wiesel quote, and actually asked me the same thing. But it was funny because that's like the one thing that was kind of going through my head the whole time, kind of keeping me like, okay, let's do this. Because 10-year-old CJ would have been like, this is what we do. Like, I don't know why you're why you're surprised.
Yeah, that's interesting that you can kind of walk in with this confidence of a child.
Yeah.
You know, before realizing that, you know, sometimes in those moments where you get too hyped up, you get too excited, then when you fail, you get really let down.
Yeah. What's the Bob Dylan lyric? He's like, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Oh yeah.
Like it's sort of this idea that when I was a kid, I was wiser and I understood these things and I had that confidence, and now I've sort of lost that.
I'm trying to figure out how to unguard myself from the disappointments of life, because so often I put up such a shield because I don't want to feel disappointed or I don't want to feel frustrated that I'm like, oh, I'm just not going to feel anything with this.
Sure.
I'm just not going to lean into the emotions for this at all. And the problem is when you succeed, which I don't know, happens more than you think it will in some ways. When you succeed, you don't feel the fruits of that victory. You don't feel the joy put up that shield beforehand, if you put up that guard. And so I'm learning how to, you know, experience more joy. And also, you know, as a result, I will experience more pain. But I don't know. I guess as a kid, you feel it all so fully on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and unfortunately, what happens is our culture doesn't give us contexts and opportunities to feel, and to feel in healthy, vibrant, productive ways.
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening, I mean, you see, and obviously there's a ton of different reasons for this, but you see the gun violence at an all-time high in these schools, and you see bullying at an all-time high, and you see self-harm just out of control. And what I think one of the major reasons for that, again, these are complex issues. There's a lot of things we can do to curb these issues. But fundamentally, you know, 80% of schools in the U.S. have removed the arts and humanities from their curriculum. And so we sit there scratching our heads going, why are our kids, why is this generation of kids unable to express themselves in positive ways? Why are they turning to such awful ways of expressing themselves? And I'm like here in the corner raising my hands going, I think there's a discipline that's been around since the dawn of time that helps human beings express themselves in positive, healthy ways. And we've removed that from our educational process.
Yeah.
Maybe if we start putting those things back, we'll see some real change happen. And that's something I'm dedicating my life to. And that's really the manifesto that is this book, is really not only helping grown-ups sort of connect with their inner kid, but hopefully challenging a generation to go, hey, look, let's raise a generation of kids where the weird doesn't get kicked out of them.
Yeah.
Where it just stays and it grows and it populates and it actually increases, so that we raise this population, this generation of human beings, where their creativity and their innovation and their empathy towards each other, all of those good things that, that art and imagination bring and weirdness brings, they're off the charts.
Yeah. Man,
we move the world forward.
Yeah. See, you know, not to get too political on this, but I think about this all the time in the context of jobs in America. You know, that was a huge part of the election. And of course, just, you know, America, it's important that people have jobs. But when I see, you know, leaders saying, we're going to bring back coal jobs, we're going to bring back manufacturing jobs, what I see is, I mean, and you've read, who's that author? Sir Ken Robinson.
Oh, yeah. He's
fantastic. Yeah. TED Talk guy. Really, I mean, he has all these thoughts on the education system. But when I think about manufacturing and coal jobs, I just think of these very procedural jobs that could be done by anybody.
Yeah.
And if they could be done by anybody, then of course they're going to end up going to other countries. And when I think about America, I think the coolest things that we've done as a country have been the innovation, the creativity, the new ideas, you know, the Walt Disneys and the Steve Jobs and people who took a risk and tried something new and then created all these opportunities. And I just think, what would it be like if our education systems, what would it be like if our societies, our schools, like the whole deal leaned into, okay, what's the weird thing we can do? What's the weird creative thing we can do? And yeah, you know, we're going to lose some of those manufacturing jobs, but we're going to be creating those jobs around the world. Like, we're going to be opening up like this whole global economy because of our ideas, not our hours and not our hands and not our procedures, but ultimately because of our minds.
So that's exactly what I'm talking about. And that's the work that I'm dedicating my life to. And the book is sort of the first step into a long kind of line of things that we're creating. If you look at all the research that's being done, you know, everybody's kind of still, I shouldn't say everybody, but there's still a cultural sort of disposition where we've got to get kids learning science, technology, engineering, and math. They call it STEM. And those are great things, by the way. But if you look at where the marketplace and where the workforce is headed, you've got automation, you've got coding, you've got all of these things, and those are great. But the thing that a lot of the researchers and a lot of these big companies, like Google, did this total crazy internal survey, you're going to need workers that understand. They call it soft skills. I don't like that phrase because it sounds soft. They mean soft skills in the term of like software versus hardware. Another word they're using for it is 21st century skills. But really, what those skills are creativity, empathy, critical thinking, imagination. It's the stuff of weirdness. It's the stuff that we're talking about that we're not teaching our kids. But you know, you've got all these parents who are going, well, okay, I need my kid to learn science and technology and how to code and stuff. Yeah, but honestly, if you're really looking at the research and common sense where everything's about to be automated, you want your kid to have a successful job in the workforce, might need to take a couple art classes.
Yeah.
You might need to take a communications class where they're understanding how to have an interpersonal dialogue to solve a problem with another human being. That's where our workforce is headed. That's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this concept of weirdness and uniqueness and creativity out of our unique selves, because that's what we need to be teaching our generation of kids right now, so that in 20, 30, 40 years, and really sooner than that, we're creating a vibrant and viable economy and culture where it isn't solely robots running the world, you know?
Totally. Well, and I'm a huge fan of coding, and I think coding is so important, but at the end of the day, it's just going to be a language.
Yeah.
It's going to be something that's communicated, and I think it's going to be a new standard. Like, I think that our grandkids are going to speak it in code to some degree,
right?
And we're going to have to figure out how to learn to translate. But the thing about language is that you have to decide what to say with that.
We need code poets.
And so you need, well, I mean, honestly, you need people who have a message to send to the world. I was in this meeting where there were all these big brands in the room, and an agency came up and they presented about Generation X, Generation Y, and Generation Z. And they said that Generation X was completely technology fluent, the first generation that really understood technology. Generation Y was social media fluent. So, you know, we really understand how to be social and connect with others and communicate in that way. But Generation Z is marketing fluent. But here, so here's the interesting thing. Like, you look at, you know, platforms like Musical.ly and, you know, young YouTube stars, and they understand how to do all of those things. They understand technology, they understand connecting with people, but they also know how to kind of market themselves and grow on social media, all these things. But what's fascinating about that is that this person said Generation Z knows the least about what they want to say. They're a tweet without words. They're an Instagram without a photo. Yeah. They're a Facebook, or, you know, they're
it's Facebook without real friends.
I mean, it's fascinating to think about how this next generation, and I'm not saying that's forever. I think that's something that can be changed, but the status of where they are now is, you know,
it needs to change. It desperately needs to change, because we are teaching the hardware. We are not teaching the software.
Yeah.
We're teaching code. We are not teaching code poets. I think it's a great thing if we create robots and AI to be empathetic, but a human has to be behind that
totally.
At some point. And so the danger of creating a workforce that only understands how to code and how to punch in the right numbers is that if you can't have an interpersonal dialogue with someone, if you can't have empathy towards each other, you're literally creating a generation of human robots. Google did this study, and Google, I mean, they're like, they research. they're
about
data. And so they did this really in-depth internal study where they went, okay, we want to know what makes all of our teams successful. And they were thinking it was going to be science, technology, engineering, and math, really, because they've had such a value throughout their hiring process of hiring the best of the best in those fields. And what they found really shocked them. This was just this last year. The team members that made their teams the most successful, that made Google the most successful, that moved their company forward, were people who had these 21st century skills, these soft skills, were people who understood how to have an empathetic conversation, how to think outside the box. And so they are reshaping their entire hiring process to look for those folks over people who can just code, who just know science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM. And so again, those things are important, but really what they're looking for on top of that, and it's not enough just to have those skills.
Yeah.
You need to have those soft skills too, which is why we need to teach our kids to get weird.
So how do we do that kind of on a practical level, like on a day-to-day level? What are the things that we do to really foster that?
Well, you know, art class, for instance, and there's so many wonderful art teachers and art programs and stuff, but again, it's, you know, 80% of schools have sort of cut this out. So we've kind of regulated art class to, oh, let's draw something cute that we can show mom and dad and stick in the refrigerator. When in reality, you know, I grew up and I felt kind of gypped because I got to college and I became a grown up and I went, wait a minute. The role of artists, you look at Picasso, you look at Dali, you look at, you know, anybody from even, you know, Beyonce, like these are, or Jay-Z, these are people who are moving culture in the direction that they want to see it go.
Hmm.
They are crossing boundaries, they are stepping over the status quo, and they are literally creating things that change people's minds. And I wish, Brandon, when I was in fourth grade, somebody would have told me that the reality of what an artist does and what art does has the capacity to change somebody's mind.
Yeah.
And so if we can help our kids understand, it doesn't matter if you're good at using a Crayola. You know, art class was like a Crayola commercial for the most part. It doesn't matter if, you know, you can use safety scissors really well or you know, draw something with a Crayola marker. You could get really, not us, but you could get really excited about using spreadsheets. You could wake up in the morning like, I cannot wait to use Microsoft Excel. There were people in our classes that were like that. And there's people all over the world who are like, give me a good spreadsheet. I can't understand that, but God bless them. If art class would have captivated those people too in fourth grade, in fifth grade, and gone, hey, look, you can actually use a spreadsheet. You can use data processing. You can be a mom. You could be a dad. You can really do whatever you want in the world. But if you look at it through the lens of an artist, you can actually have the capacity to change minds, to change paradigms. That's something that I think a lot more kids would have got on board with.
Yeah.
And really everybody needs to know. So everybody's an artist. You know, that's Picasso's quote, right? You know, all kids are artists. The problem is, you know, staying an artist when you become a grown-up.
It's really interesting thinking about the intent more than the actual product or the actual creation, saying, okay, well, the goal of art isn't just to, you know, doodle, you know, it's not just the mediums that you're using. It's not crayons on paper.
Right.
What it is, okay, how can I move the needle for whatever my goal is?
Exactly.
And that can be literally anything.
Right.
But it's that having that goal in mind, it sounds like.
Right.
So
yeah, it's something to exercise. Otherwise, it becomes really quickly something that some kids are good at and some kids aren't.
Yeah, and so
like I sucked at basketball in PE class, you know, as a kid, but I still got a workout. You know what I mean? I still ran around and I still, you know, caught the ball and I still, you know, shot it in the air and got it every, you know, 10,000 times.
Yeah.
But and missed all the other times. But still, like, I still got a workout. And so when it comes to art class, when it comes to music, when it comes to the humanities, there needs to be an understanding, I think, more of the why versus the what and even the how.
So circling back on this idea of, you know, this next generation, Gen Z, being so marketing savvy, but maybe not having the message yet, not knowing exactly what it is that they want to put out in the world, but having that full capability to do that. Where do you think we're going with that?
Well, I think we've put such an emphasis on, especially in social media and marketing, also on the word story. You know, we are story fiends, you know, in our culture, and there's Instagram stories and share your story and live a better story and your story matters and all of that stuff, and stories are great, and we're both storytellers, and I love stories. It's been this tool that since the dawn of humanity has been used to help explain things and help contextualize things. But what I fear is that we've made story kind of the end all be all, and I'm here to say it might not be a very popular opinion, but your story is not as important as you may have been told.
Hmm.
Your story doesn't matter as much because really at the end of the day, the very best, even the greatest story in the world can do is only hold a candle, only illuminate something that's already going on inside of you. It can only illuminate who you are or who you're becoming. So you walk out of a great movie, you're like, man, that was an awesome movie. Yeah, you like that because it's pinging something deep within you. It's not writing that thing in you. It's expressing that. It's illustrating that thing within you.
Yeah.
And so what I think we've lost and we need to reclaim is that your identity is more important than your story. Your identity is something, and again, you know, regardless of what you believe about the universe and spiritually, your identity is something that's been given to you. There's a place in your soul, John O'Donohue says, that is this inner sanctuary that no one can touch, that no one can manipulate. It's who you are before the world kicked it out of you. And it's deeper than any story. And the thing about a story is that you can manipulate a story. You can change the parts. You can omit things. You can add things. You can sort of shape it to fit an Instagram feed or a YouTube show or whatever it is. But if we're not sure of who we are outside of our story, that's when we run into a generation that doesn't know who they are, how to interact with others, and doesn't see the sacredness in another human being.
Man, that's so good.
We should never confuse the two.
Yeah.
Our identity is not our story.
It's
good to have a story, but you can change your story. Your identity is the sacred part, the sanctuary within your soul of who you are.
And if you're going to have a story, it seems like it should revolve around that identity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, that's interesting. That's really good. That's really
well, in
good.
A world of personal brands, we think we can shape our identity. Oh, I want to be like this and sound like this. And that's all. That's John O'Donohue would say, that's your biography. But there's a deep and hollowed place in your gut that's unconcerned with comparison and with other people's expectations. It's who you are before the world tried to conform you to a paint-by-numbers sort of situation.
Well, I think that's why I'm so drawn to people who are doing their inner work, because they know their identity. They're at a place where they truly know who they are. And, like, you know, kind of circling back to what we talked about before, you know, it's finding what makes them weird, not creating something that's weird.
Yeah. We've all been given this unique combination of matter and spirit, this strand of DNA that nobody else in the universe has. And I think our life's journey is to figure out, well, what do we do with that? We don't have to conjure it. That's the great news. So we don't have to look for it or conjure it or personally brand it or whatever. It's there. And now we just have to operate out of that and excavate that and remember that that's who we truly are.
So,
does that make sense?
Totally makes sense.
Yeah.
So we've got the systemic change that we can create, which is, you know, building systems within our education system and our schools, et cetera, to kind of encourage art, to encourage these soft skills, to encourage exploring the ways that we can use these things to make an impact. But then, and of course, you know, there's lots of ways to do that. We can, you know, contact our local city council people, our school boards, et cetera. We can, you know, vote for taxes that, you know, support our schools, things like that. But then there's also kind of the day-to-day of how we do this with our kids, you know, while we're waiting for those systems to change. You've got two kids. What are you kind of doing on a day-to-day level at home, you know, outside of these big systemic things?
Yeah, you know, one is literally fresh out of the oven. He's like 3 months old, and so he's a wild card for me. And I think every kid is different. But with Sayla, who's five, you know, and this is my wife spends more time with her in the kind of the nitty gritty day to day. And so one thing that she has just been such a rock star at is my wife is like the style queen of everything. You know what I mean? She can go to Goodwill or a thrift store and, you know, spend $5 and turn that $5 into something that looks like it's out of an Anthropologie or Urban Outfitters, you know, catalog or something like that. She's just amazing. And so she dresses awesome. She's
really cool.
She's got good style. And our five-year-old daughter will want to wear the most wild, ridiculous thing. And she's got like all, you know, Kelly's like my wife. Kelly's, you know, getting all these all, you know, awesome clothes for her and stuff. And my wife has made a really intentional decision to let our five-year-old wear whatever she wants to wear, as long as it's like within reason. You know, I'm not going to put her, we're not going to put her in like, you know, a sweater and you know, a winter coat in the middle of summer. But as long as she's, you know, safe and, you know, healthy, it's like, yeah, you want to wear plaid on plaid on plaid on whatever, like whatever it is, go for it. And you know, but it's that gut check. Cause I know,
yeah.
I even experienced, we were going to a party and she, you know, wore this crazy outfit. I'm going, everybody else is kind of going to be, you know, dressed up like, Sailor, are you sure you want to wear that? And Kelly's like, you know, I have had that thought a million times. And I go, what's really more important at the end of the day?
Yeah.
And so I think it's just really recognizing what's the most valuable, you know, is this going to prevent this kid from, you know, so anyway.
Is there a chance, you know, and this is the cynic speaking, but you know, is there a chance that one day she's going to go to school and she's going to be wearing a different outfit than all the other kids and she's going to get that weird kicked out of her?
I know. And I should preface this by saying, like, clearly just, like, figuring this out. Like, not even close to being an expert. There's a guy who, like, I don't know, you might know him, but there was a, he's got, like, a personal brand sort of thing. And, like, he, like, his wife, like, popped out a kid. And, like, I feel like the day after he, like, became the family man expert or something like that on social media and everything. I'm like, you're just like, how do you, like, none of us are, this is the emperor's new clothes. Like, none of us are experts. We're all just like hanging on to the steering wheel.
Totally.
Ripping it so tightly going, I sure hope we don't mess up, and we will. And so I'm already starting a savings account for my kids' I should be doing that, but their psychology bills because I'm sure I'm going to mess up. But what was your original question?
What happens if she goes to school and she gets the hair kicked out of her? You know, she's dressed way different than all the other kids, and other kids notice because maybe they have a much more cynical perspective than she does.
You know, I'm really scared of that, Brandon.
Yeah,
she starts kindergarten tomorrow, literally. And
oh my goodness!
And I would be lying to you if I wasn't nervous about that. I don't know. I love the public school system. I believe that if we want to see change happen within it, we should support it and be a part of that. But there's a part of me that wants to just keep her isolated and away from all of that stuff. And yet I know that that turns into a Little Mermaid, Hotel Transylvania, whatever the story is, situation where you got the dad who's like, I just want to protect you, but you know, you end up sort of isolating this kid who needs to, you know, be a part of the world, be a part of that, and experience that pain to a degree. So my best idea so far is I just wrote this book and I dedicated it to her. And honestly, from the moment I started writing to, you know, being finished with it, I had this thought in my mind, is like, write this for your daughter. Like, this is for, like, if nobody reads this, like, one day I want her to read it and go, all right, Dad, I get what you're saying, and thanks for writing this for me. So there's this chapter, I think it's my favorite chapter of the book. It's called The Myth of the Caterpillar.
Mm.
And where that really came from was I was sitting on my friend, we call her Mama Moo. She's this wonderful lady in her 60s who has this amazing, you got to go to it one day, it's an amazing farm outside of Nashville, and there's chickens and there's cows and there's wildflowers and there's tomato plants and eggplant and, you know, all of these things. It's just and she's like, you know, she's like 60 something years old working this thing every day.
It's amazing.
Oh, she's unbelievable. So I was sitting on her porch writing for a couple of days, kind of hoping that the farm would inspire me and I'd have kind of this creative breakthrough. And honestly, at the end of the day, this was like the third day I was there, I was about to leave. I was late for a meeting already, and I was kind of disappointed because I'm like, man, I didn't get any major inspiration. I'm still a little bit stuck from a writer's block perspective. And so before I left, she's like, well, come on, you got to go through the garden and pick a bunch of vegetables. I'm like, well, I'm already late. But she like scolded me a couple days before like, for not doing this already. And so I'm running through the garden, trying to get all these vegetables. She's being very generous. And in my mind, I'm just kind of going like, I need to leave and go to this meeting that I'm late for. And then she stops me. She goes, look, come on, come over here. Check this out. And so I run to her and she's cupping a tomato leaf in her hand. She goes, do you know what this is? And I go, it's a tomato leaf. Like not understanding what the whole, you know, issue is. And she's like, no, look closer. And there was this beautiful green and jet black and yellow creature. It was objectively beautiful. It was like it was amazing. She goes, This is the caterpillar that turns into a monarch butterfly. Isn't it awesome? Isn't it beautiful? I said, of course it is. There's no debate. It had bright lime green and all of these cool pops of colors and everything. And there it was. There was the inspiration right there. Hit me like a ton of bricks. Goes, my whole life I've been told the fallacy, I think, of the ugly caterpillar one day transforming into the beautiful butterfly. The ugly duckling becoming a, you know, beautiful swan. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer only becoming valuable when other people perceive his red nose as an asset to them, you know, to get them out of the fog, right? And here in this moment, looking at this tomato leaf, looking at this caterpillar, I go, well, no, the caterpillar is already beautiful. The caterpillar is already amazing. Like, it doesn't have to wait to become a butterfly. It doesn't have to wait to transform to have inherent worth and value and beauty. And now metamorphosis is awesome. Metamorphosis and transformation, we all want those things, and those are all good things, but those are things that are meant for us, not things that should be imposed on us by other people. And so going back to my daughter, the only thing I can say to her, and what I put in the book is, you know, kids will tease you at some point. Kids will make you feel less whatever. Insert, you know, beautiful, worthy, whatever. And the temptation, the easy answer, right, is to go, well, you know, there's one day he'll transform into this beautiful butterfly, and that's what, you know, just show him then. But I think that's a cheap answer. The bigger reality and the bigger invitation she can step into is, no, you're wonderful, you're full of wonder, you're full of beauty right now, right here, in the present, you don't have to wait. Your value is not contingent on somebody else's opinion. You don't have to wait to transform.
Man, CJ's conversation felt like a huge mic drop for me. And I know that last question, I asked him about his daughter and he shared these words, but I think that maybe I was asking for myself and that those words were something that I needed as well. I love this idea that CJ gets to the heart of it, that knowing what makes you weird is the best thing you can offer your art, your business, your friends, your family, and yourself. It's the essence of creativity, the stuff of movements, and the hope for humanity. If you aren't already following CJ online, do yourself a favor and follow him at CJ Cassiata on Twitter and Instagram. You'll also find everything you need to know about his work on his website, www.cjcass.com. Most importantly, after listening to this conversation, I hope that you're already planning on getting CJ's new book, Get Weird. We only spoiled a few things inside. Don't worry, there are so many ideas and concepts and brilliant lessons inside of his book. If you loved this conversation about weirdness and creativity, you would also love my conversations with unconventional fine art photographer Brooke Shaden and award-winning writer Esme Wang. You can find both of these episodes and more than 100 other episodes by searching for Sounds Good wherever you listen to podcasts. Make sure you hit subscribe to keep getting more inspiring conversations with incredible people delivered straight to your phone while you sleep. And for those of you who are regular listeners to the podcast, please consider supporting the show by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or by telling a friend about the show. It really moves the needle for us. This podcast is created by me. Brandon Harvey is a part of Good, 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 a community that believes in the power of celebrating good news and becoming good news. Chad Michael Snavely and the team at CM Studio edit and mix the show, and Christy Karen Brock offers production support. You can get lots of hopeful stories on social media by following us everywhere at Good, Good, Good CO. And we also create a beautiful quarterly newspaper that celebrates the people, ideas, and movements that are changing the world for the better. It's filled with so much good news, and it's a wonderful way to help support this podcast. You can order our latest issue of the Good Newspaper today at shop.goodgoodgood.co. We've just started shipping out issue 5 this week, and I can't wait for you to see what's inside. You can also see what else we do at Good 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 by visiting goodgoodgood.co. And on that note, that is a wrap for this week's episode. Go out and remember this truth. You do not need to wait to transform to be deemed valuable. You are already worthy and capable of making a difference, just as you are. Sound good?